This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Kieran Healy of Duke University. Kieran authored the award-winning Last Best Gifts, Altruism and the Market for Human Blood and Organs with Princeton University Press. It was Harvard, wasn't it?
Chicago.
Ah, damn it. Over two. And who, what's the title of your book coming up?
That's called Data Visualization, a Practical Introduction. And Princeton is doing that one.
All right. Yeah. Over two. More recently, Kieran made waves with an excellent theory paper in sociological theory called Trigger Warning, Fuck Nuance. He's a great sociologist. We're thrilled to have him here. Welcome, Kieran.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Kieran, let's start out with Fuck Nuance. We have to start out with Fuck Nuance. Can you give us some background on the paper? And for those of us who haven't read it, tell us what it's about.
Well, I've told the story before. It's Steve Vasey's fault, as with many things around here in North Carolina are Steve Vasey's fault. Steve wanted to organize a panel at the ASA about really against the idea of nuance in sociological theory and how there seemed to be a lot of it around. And he asked me if I would be interested in submitting a paper called something like Against Nuance. And I said, well, if you're going to do that, you might as well just bite the bullet. And really go for it. And he also, I think that one of the things that sort of pushed it over the edge was that he asked the organizer, I think it was Andy Perrin, who was the chair at the time. He wanted to call the session Against Nuance. But Andy said, well, I think you should call it, The Promise and Pitfalls of Nuance. And I said, Steve, you mean he asked you to make it more nuanced? So I took the case for the prosecution on that. And the paper, so it's got the title and all the rest of it, which Steve bound me to. But there's a real argument there that I believe.
Can you tell us the original abstract?
It was the original abstract just said seriously, fuck it.
But it's a great paper. It's a great paper, and the title should not detract from the really important argument made in it.
Yeah, and so the idea is that empirically, there's this huge spike over the last 25 years in sociology, but not just there, on the use of this term, nuance or nuanced, all pretty much without exception, people calling for more of it. And I think it's really antithetical to the project of social theory, which is a difficult thing to do, but it's fundamentally about abstraction. And in the paper, I kind of make this argument that doing theory is about throwing away specificity in order to create a bit of generalization. In order to abstract, you have to ignore how things differ and focus on the things they have in common. And the paper then outlines sort of three nuance traps that people fall into instead. One of the empirical fine grain, just constantly piling on more detail. One of the conceptual scheme, just making your ideas irrefutable through further and further distinction making within your own little system, so you lose touch with the phenomenon altogether. And then third, the nuance of the connoisseur, which is the sort of quite common experience, I think, within sociology of people just taking the stance that they're a very sophisticated thinker and they have a better sense of the nature and flow of social reality itself, and that move is always available to people, and so they take it. And so instead, I suggest that on grounds of kind of principle, style, and practical effect, we should avoid that thing. Certainly within sociology, we should avoid it. It's not an unmitigated good, right? I'm not suggesting that we should be. The argument isn't stupid, and it's not that you should just be as maximally simple as possible, but it is that in our current context, we really seem to be glutted with this move for various reasons, I guess, that we could talk about, and we should have a little less of it, I think.
I read it as the call for nuance is almost a rhetorical device or an argumentative device that isn't even that focused on the construction of more and better theory or better theories, but it's more like scoring points in an argument or looking good. What's your interpretation of the pull of nuance? Both why did it take off, and why do people love asking for nuance or demanding nuance?
Well, I think there's an internal and an external way of looking at it. Internally, within the context of an argument, just in general, you can think of the appeal of, you know, suggesting that something is more complicated than that, or saying that, well, I think we should add more detail, or we need to, you're missing a dimension here. These are standard moves and often quite valid moves in arguments, right? And so it's understandable that people would seek to make them. And in that sense, the suggestion that, you know, something needs to be refined or looked into more closely, or what have you, is quite an understandable move. The real question is the external one, which is, why is it that that move in particular would consistently take hold and expand in its prevalence, when the alternative moves, you know, we think of there should be returns in social science, but also just in general, you know, in intellectual life, there should be strong positive returns to generalization and abstraction, mm-hmm. right? We think of formal methods or modeling or just general arguments as being quite powerful, right? That's what we want to make. And so it's striking that in the last 25 years, there seems to have been this shift that, at least in some of the social sciences, that people aren't in a position to make those kind of moves anymore. And so that leads to the external question of, you know, what is happening in the social sciences that's preventing us from, or that's pushing us in this direction of nuance. And I know Gabe and I have talked about this a little bit, you know, in semi-publicly, I guess, that it's just very suggestive that, you know, when you have a large influx of people into fields and you don't have, as in sociology, we don't have a real methodological core that everybody is trained in, that we can agree on what counts as a high quality argument and what the steps you should take in that direction, you know, are, then adding empirical detail is something that everybody can do. Adding nuance or adding complexity when you're writing your dissertation is a move that's available to everyone, and it's within reach. If you want to finish your dissertation, if you want to make a contribution, then it's much easier to do that. And particularly, it's much easier to do that when you have loads and loads of other people also working, you know, in related or close by. It's much easier to sort of, in my view, fall back on the move of saying, well, here's a little more detail, or here's an extra wrinkle, or here's a little added shade of meaning. And so we get more and more nuance, and everybody becomes kind of less and less satisfied with the results, I think.
How much of this do you feel is people themselves just like thinking, I need nuance? And how much of it do you feel is the peer review process, that if you're a reviewer and you feel like you don't really have anything to say, that one thing you can always say is either, oh, this needs more nuance, or you could say, oh, but did you think about how it applies, you know, under contingency?
Yeah,
X?
I blame the internet and reviewers.
Yeah, that's always a good, right? I mean, if you start with the internet, reviewers, and original sin, that's going to cover all the bases. But like, you know, Marvin Brosler, attention today, used to always say, right. And those of you who are not Princeton PhDs, you should just know that he was this emeritus professor. He used to hang out around the Department of Music, the grad students. He used to always say that there's only two questions that ever get asked at a talk. Number one, but is it really so simple? And number two, but is it really so complicated? nuance is really just another instance of, but is it really so simple? You know, and a lot of reviewers don't like the idea of, oh, but is it really so simple? And I've definitely had peer reviews like that, like including hilariously in a computer simulation where I was just trying to say, look, this is how density dependence works. And then the reviewer is like, yes, but what if the density dependence works this way? Or what if the density dependence works that way? And I'm like, it's all density dependence. It doesn't matter, you know?
The same process or the same underlying process could be there on the reviewing side as well, right? Because the question is, why is it that this is, you know, why do reviewers ask for this? There's no intrinsic reason that they would make the isn't it more complicated than that move instead of the isn't it simpler than that move. And for me, the issue is, I think the more I think about this question, the more, you know, it's tempting to sort of point to the hollowing out of theory as a sort of coherent shared project within American sociology since essentially Merton, I would say, since the 1960s. And the fragmentation of social theory, the Parsonian project blows up in the 1960s. Merton holds the ground for a little bit with middle range approaches, but then you get this huge fragmentation and you have everything from ethnomethodology to network analysis to gender theory to critical race theory. You get this huge heterogeneity of approaches, all essentially incompatible, and each trying and failing, I think, to sort of replace the what had previously come before. And instead of taking over, any one of them winning and establishing its particular vision and method, and particularly its method for evaluating what theory should be, instead you get sort of these little islands or fragments going along. And at that point, then what happens is, in the review process, for example, or in the literature review phase, or in the making your own argument phase, well, now you have theory becomes not a world where there's a shared model, not necessarily a formal model, but like a shared approach and for making an argument, but instead all of these kind of floating islands that never quite properly compete with each other, and the hapless graduate student or the poor assistant professor starting out is forced to sort of account for all of them.
Yeah.
And I think that process is exacerbated too because it piles in on itself, because insofar as we have formal methods like quantitative methods, they for a long time they lent themselves to just add more variables. Yes. and each one of which can stand for weakly some one of these theories, and so the result is this kind of hodgepodge where you don't get the opportunity to reestablish the but isn't it simpler than that part of the dialectic, and we spiral off into isn't it always more complicated than that?
Do you think analytical sociology has the potential to bring in a isn't it simpler than that mentality?
Well, I think that any of these, to be honest, I think that almost any of these approaches in principle have the potential to become to push that forward. It's more a question of whether any of them are likely, as a matter of kind of a disciplinary fact, to become a sustained focus of attention in terms of intellectual development, with everybody agreeing to sort of, well, we need to work on this set of problems using these methods, like approaching it in this particular way with this style of evaluation. And so while I think something like analytical sociology has the desire to push back in the direction of things being simpler with a coherent vocabulary that people share, I'm skeptical that it's going to have, just as a matter of disciplinary influence, I'm skeptical that it's going to have that actual impact in practice. And the reason for that, again, is that you can just look at what's happening in graduate training in departments. We don't theory is dead essentially. Yeah. as a graduate training, as a focus of graduate training, and as an occupational an occupational niche within the field. And it died in the 80s pretty much, or early 1990s, and we're starting to pay the price now, I think, in terms of a slide, I think, towards all of the tendencies that we see all the time in social, the balkanization, a lack of shared standards of inquiry. And I speak of this like, this isn't like a moral critique. It's just kind of it's one of the things that makes it harder for the discipline to hold together. And so within any given pocket, within any given subfield, you can have these sort of standards will start to sort of reassert themselves as people say, okay, well, here we are now in demography, or here we are now in gender theory, or here we are in health and social behavior or something. And we know what our debates are within this field, and we'll have them according to those standards. But the sort of disciplinary core and the promise of more general theory kind of fades.
So on a more practical level, if you're an assistant professor, if you're a graduate student, and you feel like you're being confronted with demands for nuance where you feel they're not warranted, like how does someone navigate that practically? How can we differentiate?
You cite my paper.
And you know what? I've done that. I have a paper, another paper using a simulation, and I already cite your paper to, make the point that simulations have to be parsimonious, because every once in a while you get a reviewer who doesn't understand that's the point. They think that you're not making a very simple simulation. They basically expect you to make GTA 5 and write a paper about it. But, you know.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you know, so I'm joking mostly. You should cite the paper. you need to have some sort of, you know, basis for pushing back. And that's one of them to have. Because one of the things that happened when I wrote this paper is that when it got published, there really was this sort of element of, it was almost like a sort of pluralistic ignorance moment where, you know, it's not, of course, not everybody liked the paper, and I wouldn't expect everybody to by any means. And if everybody liked it, it would be a sign that something was wrong. But there was this big rush of people going, oh yeah, you know, that's really true. Or I've had this experience, or this is something that happened. And I'm glad that that someone is there kind of just staking that the alternative out. So it's hard for individuals at the level of reviews on a particular paper to fight these broader forces, and they really think, you know, they shouldn't have to. And the best you can do is try to make the cleanest argument that you can, you know, that's consistent with the data or the point that you want to want to make.
In copy editing, if necessary. I've passively taken citations out that I feel are valueless, which reviewers have maybe.
And so that is a matter of, you know, cultivating style, and it's hard to fight. And then editors have a responsibility to, you know, not to lead people down that path. I mean, I think the journal editors in sociology are unusually powerful, precisely because we tend to lack shared disciplinary standards for evaluating quality. That's the reason, for instance, that the hierarchy of journals is more important than the hierarchy of departments within sociology, and because everybody can agree in a fairly heterogeneous field that getting published in ASR or AJS is, you know, that's something we can sort of intersubjectively agree on as a mark of quality, even if we disagree with the methods or approaches. And if we agreed more, again, this isn't like a, you know, a normative point. It's just where, you know, at what point does the status order, where does it exist? You know, where does it bite? And in social bites at the level of getting into journals, even though many people disagree with your whole approach or something, but you have to agree that it's good. And so that means the journal editors then are very powerful, and the standards that they demand can really change the way their field is working.
So if we could go back a second to talking about, you know, this kind of structure of the discipline and how it affects it. I totally agree with you that we have a weak paradigm field, and this makes it hard to agree on kind of a coherent worldview. And if we had more, you know, monocausal explanations or whatever, or at least a single idea, it would make it easier to have less of a focus on nuance. And you know, this is especially the case of the top journals, where they explicitly say you have to speak to multiple areas of discipline, et cetera, et cetera. But I also feel that there's some part, some theories, some traditions that are more amenable to nuance than others. And, you know, you mentioned like critical race theory and ethnomethodology. To me, those are theoretical perspectives that are opposed to parsimony in principle. Ethnomethodology is all about how everything that's worth having comes out of the details of interaction. One step over from that, you have thick description, which is basically to say, you know, we don't, it should be 100% nuance. There should be nothing but the nuance. There should be no theory at all, just nuance. And then you have various types of critical theory are very interested in intersectionality, which is basically a fancy way of saying we're interested in the contingencies of, you know, we don't want to know how race works and we don't want to know how gender works. We want to know how race works together with gender, which is implicitly saying we demand nuance.
There's something to that, although I also think that sort of conditions out in the world will have a lot of impact on the content of theory within a field. So, for example, one of the things that I did when I was prepping this paper in order to give some evidence that nuance really was on the rise across many fields and within sociology was to look at trends in the use of the word by journal, right? Including both in the generalist journals, which is in the paper, but also in a bunch of specialty journals. And there's one very suggestive trend. It's mostly going up in many places. And one place where it's gone off the edge of a cliff in the last, you know, decade or so is in gender and society. Now, that could be a complete coincidence, right? And I'm not suggesting that. But it's also tempting to think that, you know, that gender theory, which you might think of as, you know, as you were saying, as one of these fields that was very focused on, you know, nuance, the fine grain and all the rest of it in the 80s and 90s. I think that the transformation in the world on things like debates about trans identities or you know, same-sex marriage, all that kind of things, has really revitalized that field theoretically. And much more interesting things are happening in it now if you ask me, as and I'm not a specialist in these areas or anything, but you know, it seems to me that there's more going on intellectually in that field in the last decade or so than there was maybe in the 10 or 15 years before that. And it's tempting, you know, to see that as linked to, you know, the decline in the use of nuance. Right now, something is happening out in the world, and it demands a much sharper theory. And you know, and I wonder if we would see the same with critical race stuff, you know, in the wake of Black Lives Matter or similar kinds of moves that suddenly, you know, even if the vocabulary didn't change that much, that the emphasis would be in term, you know, in the direction of much sharper and less nuanced arguments.
I think it works the other way around too, right? I mean, so I actually think you have movements like, for example, Black Lives Matter that takes on, right, you know, that uses, you know, the literature that talks about intersectionality, for example, right, as, you know, sort of, you know, like part of their calling card, part of who they are. And I actually think, thinking about intersectionality, like across disciplines and its use, I think that also helps to explain a lot of the things that you might tag as, you know, I was like, here's the rise of nuance here.
I think that's a very important point. And one of the things I say towards the end of the paper is that it's important to bear in mind that many concepts, there's a relational quality to how nuanced they appear. And so something like intersectionality, for example, depending on the audience that it's being presented to and the context in which that's being presented, it can appear, you know, more or less interesting or more or less compelling. And so if you, you know, it's been established, say, within the social sciences for a long time, but if you take it out into a more political context, then it can reacquire its cutting edge and be, you know, used as a, in a much sharper way. Whereas if you're a critical race theorist and you're presenting to an audience of sociologists and your point is I'm going to show you how this, you know, outcome is intersectional, they're less likely to be interested because they already believe that to be true. And so you know, it's not necessarily, you know, the concept itself can change how abstract it seems or how sharp it seems depending on who it's being used, you know, with respect to.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.